Welcome to the Cabinet of Science and Fiction.
Today we are opening a particularly dense and fascinating file.
We really are. This deep dive is going to look beyond just, you know, simple reports of strange lights in the sky.
Exactly. Our mission here is to analyze some of the most iconic mass witness and institutionally significant UFO encounters, or as they're now called, UAP encounters.
Right. Unidentified aerial phenomena. And we're going to be looking at these over the last, 60 years or so?
That's right. We're specifically blending primary witness accounts.
And these are not just anyone. We're talking professional air traffic controllers, fighter pilots.
Hundreds of ordinary citizens, even school children. And we're putting those accounts alongside official documents and, importantly, the analysis of social and political scientists.
Because the core theme here, and this is what really gets me, is this profound, almost impossible gap that opens up.
The gap between what?
Between overwhelming corroborated evidence on one side and this powerful head-on institutional denial on the other.
Mm-hmm. And that's where we're aiming to understand what scholars call the UFO taboo.
The UFO taboo. Explain that a little.
It's the authoritative refusal by our consensus-producing institutions, government, military, sometimes even science, to take the phenomenon seriously.
Even when there's objective data.
Even with objective multi-source data. So we're looking at this not just as a history of strange sightings, but as a study in how power, you know, maintains its version of reality.
Okay, so let's unpack this for everyone listening. We're looking at cases where the most credible people imaginable.
People whose jobs rely on accuracy.
Precisely. Pilots, military officers, they saw things that defy any easy explanation.
And then what happened?
The official records vanish. The physical evidence gets destroyed. The witnesses are silenced or, worse, ridiculed.
And here's where it gets really interesting, because these are not, you know, isolated, blurry snapshots.
No, absolutely not. These are incidents involving hundreds of people, sometimes across entire continents.
And in these cases, institutional force was actively, and you could say aggressively, deployed to just put a lid on the truth.
So to start, where are we heading first?
To start, we head to Australia. We're going to look at one of the most significant daylight mass witness events ever recorded, the Westall High School sighting.
Westall. Okay, so paint the picture for us.
We're in suburban Melbourne. The date is April 6, 1966. It's the day before the Easter break, so the atmosphere at the school is probably a little energetic.
But setting is so crucial here. It's 10:15 in the morning. This is not some fleeting nighttime glimpse.
No, it's a clear, bright morning in a populated suburban area, and the number of witnesses is just astonishing. We're talking well over 300 students and staff.
300 people. All in the same place at the same time.
And the initial sighting occurred when two physical education classes were outside on the school oval, Form 1 and Form 3 students.
So young teenagers.
Right. And they were with several teachers, including a Miss Jeanette Muir. What struck them first, and this is a recurring detail in these reports.
The silence.
They were close to Moorabbin Airport, so they were used to engine noise. But they heard absolutely nothing as this object approached.
And when they finally saw it, how consistent were the descriptions? Because with that many witnesses, you'd expect some variation.
Remarkably consistent. And that's a key factor when you're dealing with mass testimony.
Yeah.
Witnesses described a silent, silver or white, shiny, metallic-looking object.
What about the shape?
They often referred to it as being shaped like an upside-down bowl, or sometimes a disc with a small dome on top. And the size estimates put it at roughly that of one or two standard cars.
And these are people who see planes every day.
Constantly. They knew what a plane or a helicopter looked and sounded like. They were certain this was neither.
It lacked all the normal features.
Completely. No sound, no windows, no visible engines, no wings, no fins, no markings, nothing.
Yet it was clearly flying, not just floating.
It was executing controlled flight, hovering with what seemed like intent, then moving with incredible speed. And the students, you know, they reacted with, with panic and confusion. It was so abnormal.
And the movement was the next striking factor, right?
Yes. The craft began moving across the school property towards a place known as the Grange. It was a parcel of land about 400 meters away with a cluster of tall pine trees.
And witnesses described its movement as, what was the word? Flitting.
Flitting, yeah. Darting from one side of the sky to the other, ascending, descending, turning at speeds just far beyond anything conventional.
This is where the story just escalates, though. It goes from a sighting to something more.
It becomes a potential military interaction. Suddenly, five small Cessna-like aircraft appeared.
Out of nowhere.
They came from the direction of Moorabbin Airport. They flew low towards the strange object, and it looked for all the world like they were trying to engage it.
And the students watching from the ground, they described this as a game of cat and mouse.
A high-stakes, extremely rapid game of cat and mouse. The conventional aircraft were just no match for the UFO's agility.
So every time the planes tried to get close,
the object would just rapidly accelerate away, stop on a dime, hover, and then evade them again. It was demonstrating flight characteristics that they defy known Newtonian physics.
How long did this go on for?
Nearly 20 minutes. And after this aerial display, the craft executed a sharp descent, dropping down behind those pine trees at the Grange.
And the students, I imagine.
They went wild. Dozens of them. Highly agitated, ignoring the teachers who are desperately trying to get control, they just jumped the fences and ran towards the landing site.
They wanted to see what happened.
Of course. And the ones who got there first, they saw the final moments of the event.
Which were?
They saw the craft lifting off, turning briefly onto its side, and then it just vanished.
Vanished how? Flew away really fast.
Not in a traditional sense. They said it just disappeared in the blink of an eye. The five circling planes were just left there in an empty sky.
But it left something behind. This is the crucial part.
Critical evidence. When the first groups of students arrived at that clearing, they discovered definitive physical trace evidence. A huge, conspicuous, and perfect circle of flattened grass.
And the physical details they reported were? They were meticulous.
They were. The grass inside the circle wasn't just crushed. The stalks were described as being distinctly swirled around in one direction.
Like it was spun down.
Almost perfectly laid flat. And there was also a distinct perimeter ring of discolored grass surrounding the circle.
Discolor how?
Many witnesses recalled it seemed scorched or singed or burnt. It suggested intense heat or maybe radiation exposure.
And there was more, wasn't there? The indentations.
Yes. They reported three small indentations in the ground near the center of the circle, consistent with a tripod landing gear.
Even though they didn't see any landing feet when it took off.
Right. And importantly, the witnesses who arrived first were very clear on this. There were no tracks around the site. No vehicle tracks, no human tracks, nothing to suggest a mundane explanation.
So this is the point where the story should be about investigation, right? What is this thing?
You would think so. But this is the moment the institutional mechanism of denial just slams down.
Yeah.
Hard.
With the headmaster, Mr. Frank Sammel?
Yes. He attempted to restore order, not by investigating, but by intimidation. He called an assembly.
And what did he say?
He unequivocally declared that flying saucers did not exist, that the students had seen nothing important, and he severely reprimanded and threatened punishment for any staff or students who dared to speak to the media.
Just shut it down completely.
And the suppression was clearly coming from outside the school. Witnesses recall seeing mysterious figures standing alongside the headmaster during that very assembly.
Men in suits.
People in dark suits or dark blue uniforms.
Right.
The consensus among the frankly terrified students was that these men were from the government.
And they were there for one reason.
To put a lid on things.
Mm-hmm.
Several of the key student witnesses were taken to the headmaster's office and interrogated harshly by these men.
And it wasn't just the students who were scared.
No, the science teacher, a Mr. Andrew Greenwood, a credible adult witness who saw the object and called its maneuvers the most amazing flying he had ever seen in his life. He later spoke to an American physicist, Dr. James E. McDonald.
And he confirmed the story.
He confirmed the headmaster ordered total silence under threat of punishment. He said Sambolby was scared and disturbed by it all. He was clearly just following orders from someone else.
So they silenced the witnesses. What about the physical evidence, the circle and the grass?
The cleanup operation was clinical and brutal. An electrical engineering student from a nearby university went to the site the very next day.
And what did he find?
The area was completely sealed off. Barricades. Soldiers on point duty.
Soldiers? For a patch of grass near a high school?
Exactly. Soldiers were seen getting out of trucks with what looked like Geiger counters and metal detectors, sweeping the area.
Looking for radiation?
Or unusual materials.
Right.
And when that student tried to get a closer look, he was just told, in no uncertain terms, to piss off.
So what happened to the circle?
When that student went back a week later, the soldiers and barricades were gone. But so was the evidence. It had been erased.
Erased how? Did the grass just grow back?
With extreme prejudice. The whole area containing the circle had been deliberately and meticulously burnt.
Burnt. They set fire to the field.
They incinerated the trace evidence entirely. This swift, complete destruction of the physical evidence shows an operational effectiveness that goes way beyond just ignoring a story. This is active suppression.
And the information vanished from the public record, too.
Completely. The local paper, the Dandenong Journal, ran it as a front-page story for 2 weeks. But the photos their own photographer took of the circle never published.
And the TV report.
Even more telling. A Channel 9 GTV news report with actual witness interviews, which many of the witnesses remember watching that night, was later permanently removed from their archives.
And a TV station would normally keep everything.
Indefinitely. The photos and notes taken by the local UFO research group, who were first on the scene after the military, they also vanished without a trace.
So Westall really gives us our first template for this UFO taboo in action.
It's the perfect template. Hundreds of credible witnesses, clear physical evidence, and a ruthless, multi-pronged effort to silence people and incinerate the proof.
It's how that epistemology of ignorance you mentioned starts. You just destroy the data itself.
Precisely. Now let's transition from suburban Australia to the tense military atmosphere of the Cold War in Europe.
Okay, where are we now?
We're going to the Rendlesham Forest incident in Suffolk, England, in late December of 1980.
Ah, Britain's Roswell.
That's what it's often called. Because of the multi-night duration, the high-ranking military involvement, and the detailed official records that actually survived the initial denial.
And the location here is paramount. Rendlesham Forest is right next to two U.S. Air Force bases, RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge.
And during this period, these were critical NATO installations. They were reportedly storing substantial amounts of nuclear weapons.
So any airspace intrusion is not just a curiosity, it's an existential threat, a massive defense incident.
Absolutely. The events began late on night one, specifically the early hours of December 26th. Security patrolmen, including an Airman First Class John Burroughs and Staff Sergeant Jim Peniston, were sent out.
To investigate what?
Strange lights that were reported descending into the woods right near the east gate of RAF Woodbridge.
Their initial thought must have been a crash.
Exactly. They assumed they were dealing with a downed civilian aircraft, which is why they moved in so quickly. But as they got into the dense forest, they found something far, far stranger.
The object.
A glowing metallic triangular object. The witnesses were a bit divided on whether it was hovering just above the ground or if it was actually resting silently on three tripod-like legs in a small clearing.
And Sergeant Peniston got the closest, right? His testimony is incredible.
He provides unbelievable detail. He described the craft as triangular, made of a dark, smooth, glass-like metallic material.
And he claimed he actually touched it.
He did. He reached out and touched the warm surface, and he noted that he felt a constant low-level electrical voltage running through the hull.
And the most striking part of his testimony for me are the symbols.
The hieroglyphic symbols, yeah. He said they were etched into the surface, pictorial designs, about 3 inches high. He said they didn't seem to have any rhyme or reason, but they were undeniably manufactured.
So not natural markings?
No. The craft had swirling blue and yellow lights on its exterior, but it operated in complete silence.
And then it just took off.
After Peniston finished his assessment, he determined, according to his notes, that the craft was non-hostile. It lifted off.
How did it blast off?
It maneuvered through the dense pine trees without disturbing a single branch, rose slightly, and then just accelerated away at an unbelievable rate of speed, gone in an instant.
And just like at Westall, there was physical evidence left behind.
Yes. The next morning, investigators went back to the site, and they found definitive physical evidence that matched the initial description.
The three indentations.
Three small conical indentations in the ground, forming a perfect triangular pattern. It confirmed the tripod-like landing gear story.
What else did they find?
They also noted scorch marks on nearby trees and broken branches, suggesting intense heat or energy had affected the immediate environment. And critically, they took radiation readings.
Radiation? That's hard evidence.
You'd think so. Science staff at the UK Ministry of Defense later analyzed these readings and concluded they were significantly higher than the average background radiation for that location.
But this is where it gets complicated, right? This is a perfect example of how institutions neutralize hard data.
It is. The National Radiological Protection Board, the NRPB, later dismissed the readings.
On what grounds?
They argued that the equipment used was designed for detecting high-level gamma radiation from, say, a bomb blast, not for precise background measurement, so they could claim the readings were potentially meaningless or flawed.
That's the classic institutional strategy, isn't it? Don't deny the readings exist.
Deny their meaning. It allows them to acknowledge the data while simultaneously invalidating it.
So the drama didn't end there. It intensified on night two.
December 28th, the deputy base commander, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Hault, who was initially very skeptical of his men's story, he personally led a team back into the woods.
And he recorded the whole thing.
Live. On what became famous as a Hault tape.
And the tape is just, it's a primary document. You can hear the events unfold in real time.
You hear Hault documenting seeing lights that almost burns your eyes. He notes a beam of light coming down to the ground. He also confirms seeing a light that flashed consistently at a 5-second interval.
And that 5-second interval became central to the skeptical arguments later on.
It did. But Hault later filed a detailed official memorandum to the UK Ministry of Defense. This was dated January 13th, 1981, and it confirmed the gravity of what happened.
He went on the record as a lieutenant colonel.
His report stated the object was metallic in appearance and triangular in shape, with a pulsing red light on top and blue lights underneath. He meticulously documented the ground indentations and the elevated radiation.
He became the highest-ranking military officer to ever go on record about a UFO sighting at that time.
He did. And he also claimed that the object returned and fired what he called shafts of light at his team and later at a sensitive weapons storage area of the base.
A weapons storage area, likely where the nuclear weapons were. And yet, the official response...
Despite the object being tracked on military radar, the official response from the UK Ministry of Defense was the standard dismissive line.
Yeah.
The incident was judged to be of no defense significance.
No defense significance. An unknown craft lands next to a nuclear base, and that's of no significance.
It drew immediate and sharp critique. Lord Hill Norton, a former 5-star admiral and former chairman of NATO's military committee, he publicly called the MOD's denial absurd.
He laid out the logical dilemma, didn't he?
Perfectly. He said, look, either an unidentified craft intruded and landed on the perimeter of a nuclear base, or your deputy commander and his men were hallucinating or lying.
And either of those possibilities must be of defense significance.
Of course. To claim otherwise is a political act, not a military assessment.
Okay, let's pivot to the skeptical counter-explanations, because they are very strong in this case.
They are. The most famous is the lighthouse theory.
The 5-second flashing interval.
It perfectly matches the frequency of the nearby Orford Ness Lighthouse, just 5 miles away.
Skeptics also argue the initial lights could have been a bright meteor re-entering the atmosphere. That was widely reported across southern England that night.
Right. And the physical evidence was also aggressively questioned. The local forest guard identified the landing marks not as indentations, but as rabbit holes.
Rabbit holes.
Covered in pine needles. And the scorch marks were dismissed as just pre-existing axe cuts from foresters.
But even if we accept all of that, the lighthouse, the rabbit holes, which is a huge leap.
It is.
Why did the deputy base commander put his entire career on the line by officially filing that memo under penalty of perjury about a high security incident?
That brings us back to the institutional core.
Yeah.
Regardless of the final explanation, the official U.S. response after the incident was punitive.
Punitive how?
Hault reported that the USAF Office of Special Investigations, the OSI, the military police, they launched a harsh interrogation of the key witnesses, like Burroughs and Peniston.
What did they do to them?
They threatened their careers, they administered drugs, they used hypnosis to verify the stories, causing what Hault called lasting, damaging effects on the airmen involved.
So this is the second technique of repression we see. It's not just denying the data.
It's deploying disciplinary measures against the very professionals whose reports generated the data in the first place.
The pattern is consistent. A multi-layered military encounter results in official denial, ambiguity about evidence, and punishment for the witnesses.
And that ensures that breaking the UFO taboo has personal career-ending consequences.
Now, that metallic triangular shape seen at Rendlesham,
yeah,
that's part of a much bigger phenomenon, right? The black triangles.
It is. Which brings us to two huge mass sightings that really illustrate the fine line between a genuine anomaly and, well, deliberate deception.
The Belgian UFO wave and Phoenix Lights.
Let's start with the Belgian UFO wave. This ran intensely from late 1989 to 1992. It was an unprecedented situation.
Unprecedented how?
Thousands of citizens, including police and military personnel, reported seeing these large, silent, triangular craft with bright lights at each corner.
And there was often a large, pulsing red light in the center.
That's right. The consensus of description across the whole country was staggering. It led the authorities to launch over 650 official investigations.
And crucially, the sightings weren't just visual.
They were radar verified. and this high level of corroboration prompted military action. The Belgian Air Force took the report seriously enough to scramble two F-16 fighter jets on the night of March 30, 1990.
To intercept these radar targets.
Yes. And what happened next demonstrates those impossible maneuvers we keep talking about.
The F-16s engaged the objects, but the targets.
They executed rapid changes in speed and altitude that defied known physics. They accelerated from basically zero to over 1,000 miles per hour. And critically, they descended from 10,000 feet to just 500 feet in under 5 seconds.
That kind of G-force. It would kill a human pilot. It would tear apart any known aircraft.
The pilots only achieved radar lock for a few seconds at a time before the targets just rapidly evaded the jets. The performance was far beyond anything known at the time.
So what was the official explanation?
Official ambiguity. General Wilfred de Brouwer, who was chief of operations for the Belgian Air Force, he later confirmed a few crucial facts.
Okay, what were they?
First, that no secret military flights by NATO or anyone else took place. Second, the objects committed a severe infraction against aviation rules. And third, the Air Force could not identify the nature, origin, and intentions of the reported phenomena.
But there was a caveat, wasn't there? The institutional need for denial.
There always is. He acknowledged that specific weather conditions could have caused false returns on the radar screens. So the official statement manages to confirm the military encounter while also providing a loophole for future dismissal.
And this is where the influence of a single piece of compelling evidence comes in, the photograph.
The famous photograph of the triangular object taken by a man named Patrick Marichal. It was held up globally for years as the definitive photographic proof.
It became the symbol for the entire wave. But in 2011, the truth came out.
It did. Marichal confessed that the photograph was a carefully constructed hoax.
A hoax? How?
He and his friends had built a model out of painted styrofoam, hung it from a string, and shone lights on it.
Wow, and that is a profound moment of reflection for researchers.
It is, an event involving thousands of witnesses and F-16 radar engagements, which remains unexplained, becomes associated with a deliberate, childish hoax.
It demonstrates the power of mass suggestion and the human desire for a simple photographic explanation.
And the hoax ends up contaminating the memory of the real, unexplained event.
Which brings us to the United States and the Phoenix Lights. March 13, 1997.
Another classic Black Triangle case. It's often cited as the most widely witnessed UFO event in history, seen by thousands across 300 miles from Nevada all the way to Arizona.
And this case is famous because its mystery largely came from mixing up two entirely separate military events into one single inexplicable story.
Exactly. Event one happened in the early evening. This was the sighting of the massive V-shaped or Carpenter's square-shaped craft.
Witnesses described a colossal object, maybe a mile wide, gliding silently and just blotting out the stars as it passed over.
The witness credibility here was startlingly high. It even included the governor at the time, Fife Symington.
Who initially joked about it.
He did. He joined other officials in making light of it. But years later, he admitted he saw an otherworldly craft, and he noted that the political pressure to deny it was immediate and pervasive.
So what's the skeptical explanation for this giant V-shape?
It's highly plausible, and it matches air traffic data. The object was likely a formation of five A-10 Thunderbolt 2-second Warthog attack aircraft.
A formation of planes.
Yes. Returning to Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, when you see them at high altitude in a tight V formation at night, the running lights of the planes can combine to create the illusion of a single, massive, dark object. It's a classic case of perspective creating an anomaly.
But that visual ambiguity was cemented by event two, which happened later that evening.
Around 10:00 p.m., a row of brilliant stationary lights that appeared in an arc over the Estrella Mountains near Phoenix. This is the event most people have seen on video.
And this sighting was actually confirmed by the military.
It was, but with an explanation. A Lieutenant Colonel Ed Jones confirmed that these were LUU-2BB illumination flares.
Flares.
High-altitude, long-burning flares dropped from A-10 Warthogs during training exercises at the nearby Barry Goldwater Range.
And the visual illusion here is the key.
It's essential. The flares are dropped several kilometers away, and they descend slowly and vertically. So observers in Phoenix perceive them as stationary, hovering lights.
And they appear to wink out one by one.
Not because they vanished, but because their slow, vertical descent was sequentially blocked by the Sierra Estrella Mountains in the distance.
So the Phoenix Lights mystery, it was really the result of conflating a formation of aircraft with a flare drop.
Both of which are explainable military activities.
Yeah.
But you combine them into a single narrative, and you get a story about a colossal, inexplicable alien craft.
It's a powerful lesson in how institutional denial sometimes doesn't even need to destroy the evidence.
It just needs to let the public mix up the explainable data with the ambiguous observations.
Okay, let's turn to two more recent cases where the witnesses were professional air staff, pilots, air traffic controllers.
People whose jobs are entirely predicated on identifying everything in the sky. Their observations are usually considered the gold standard of credibility.
We'll start in the United States with the Chicago O'Hare sighting on November 7, 2006.
This is a crucial example of institutional minimization at a major security nexus. It's around 4.14 p.m., and a disc-shaped metallic gray object is seen hovering silently above Gate C-17 at O'Hare, one of the world's busiest airports.
And this was highly corroborated. About a dozen United Airlines employees saw it. Pilots, ramp workers, supervisors.
A ramp worker actually noticed it first and told the crew of United Airlines Flight 446 that there was a UFO hovering over their plane. The pilot and co-pilot both reportedly saw it clearly.
And the object was visible for about 2 minutes. Before it shot up and vanished, it left a really peculiar trace.
The hole in the sky.
A discernible hole, or a circular void, punched directly through the overcast cloud ceiling.
And as one UFO researcher stressed, these witnesses are trained observers. They know what's supposed to be in the sky. This isn't a farmer in a remote field. This is high-level professional testimony.
And the institutional response.
Immediate denial. Both the FAA and United Airlines initially denied having any knowledge of or information about the sighting. They tried to enforce that epistemology of ignorance through just not talking.
But their silence broke after the Chicago Tribune started investigating and filed a Freedom of Information Act request.
Yes, a FOIA request.
Yeah.
And that forced the FAA to review their air traffic control tapes. And that revealed a key piece of evidence that proved they were lying.
The phone call.
A phone call from a United Airlines supervisor reporting the incident directly to an on-site FAA manager. They knew about it all along.
So even after being forced to admit they knew, what was their final conclusion?
Pure institutional deflection. They concluded the sighting resulted from ambient weather conditions.
Ambient weather conditions.
Like a hole punched in the clouds by some mundane meteorological effect.
That's a classic case of the UFO taboo. Dismissing a metallic disc seen hovering silently over a gate at a high-security airport as weather is just. It's politically useful.
It is. It lets the FAA avoid its legal duty to investigate a potential security compromise or an airspace violation. It maintains the illusion of total sovereign control.
Okay, let's move across the Atlantic now to the Alderney sighting in the English Channel in 2007.
And here, the reported scale of the object just challenges all conventional explanations.
This happened on April 23, 2007. Captain Ray Boyer, a very experienced pilot, was flying a Tracelander.
And he observed a structured object about 10 miles west of Alderney. He initially described it through binoculars as a thin cigar or a CD viewed on edge, sharply defined.
And as he flew closer, he realized there was a second identical shape beyond the first.
Right. So he immediately contacted Jersey Air Traffic Control and reported the objects.
And here is the crucial piece of objective data.
The controller, a man named Paul Kelly, confirmed two primary radar contacts south of Alderney.
Primary radar. That means a solid object, but no transponder information.
No identity. Unauthorized and unknown. And they were moving slowly at just 6 knots.
And Captain Boyer's testimony was quickly corroborated by another commercial pilot.
Captain Patrick Patterson, flying a Blue Islands Jetstream, he gave a similar description from the opposite direction.
But the real mind-bending detail came later, after Captain Boyer had time to analyze what he saw.
He realized that because the object was visible and maintained its size from about 40 miles away, he had vastly underestimated its true dimensions.
And he later estimated the object's size to be
an astonishing 1 mile long.
A mile-long structured object.
Corroborated by multiple professional pilots and tracked on civilian ATC radar moving through controlled airspace.
So how did the establishment react to a mile-long object near the English coast?
Predictably, with classic indifference. The UK Ministry of Defense denied any relevant UK military activity. Research suggested both the French and British military were aware of the radar contacts, but officially, they weren't bothered by it.
They just weren't bothered.
A subsequent scientific report was commissioned. It investigated all sorts of natural phenomena reflections, sun dogs, even a theoretical concept called earthquake lights.
And what did it conclude?
It concluded that none of these could satisfactorily explain the sighting without discounting at least some significant features of the reports.
So the mile-long structured object confirmed by radar remains unexplained.
Unexplained by conventional science. And yet the institutional machinery just allowed the story to fade away.
So we've reviewed 5 major, highly corroborated incidents spanning 40 years, 3 continents: Westall, Rendlesham, the Belgian Wave, O'Hare, Alderney.
And in every single one, overwhelming evidence, visual, radar, physical traces, was met with immediate authoritative denial, record destruction, or just far-fetched natural explanations.
This forces us to analyze the theoretical engine behind this behavior, the UFO taboo.
And this authoritative disregard for UFOs, it isn't accidental. It's not because of incompetence. It's structural.
And the academic concept that explains this comes from political science, from scholars like Alexander Wendt and Raymond Duvall.
Right. They discuss how UFO denial is rooted in the preservation of what they call anthropocentric sovereignty.
Okay, explain anthropocentric sovereignty for us in a conversational way. Why does a potential flying saucer threaten the whole political structure?
Well, anthropocentric sovereignty is the fundamental premise that humans rule the world. It's the foundation upon which all modern states, international law, all our systems of rule are based.
The idea that we are the ultimate authority on this planet.
We are. Our states are legitimate because there's nothing above them. So if you, as a government, were to confirm advanced non-human phenomena,
the extraterrestrial hypothesis, or EF,
if that were confirmed as real, it would fundamentally invalidate human sovereignty.
I see. So if a superior non-human power is operating here, it would render human rule sort of obsolete.
Precisely. The sovereign power doesn't repress the UFO phenomenon because it's afraid of aliens. It represses it because it's afraid of what acknowledging the aliens would reveal about itself.
Which is?
The ultimate insecurity and fragility of modern rule.
That raises the core scientific conflict then. How can it be rational for governments to fund SETI programs searching for faint signals light years away,
yet be irrational and taboo to investigate objects that are physically documented and tracked right here on Earth?
The answer is political, not scientific.
That's what Wendt and Duvall argue. The sovereign state turns away from the UFO problem. It insists that the answer is known in advance to have a conventional explanation.
Like the FAA saying the metallic disc over O'Hare was ambient weather.
Exactly. They characterize this resistance as a form of denial, almost like in psychoanalysis. The sovereign represses the UFO out of a fundamental fear of its own political dissolution.
And this repression is enforced through specific observable techniques. We've seen them in every case we've talked about.
We can map these cases perfectly onto the 4 techniques the U.S. government uses to enforce this epistemology of ignorance.
The process by which ignorance is actively produced and enforced?
Right. So the first technique is authoritative representation.
This involves portraying the serious study of UFOs as pseudoscience, something for ridicule.
Like the FAA's quick dismissal of O'Hare, or the MOD claiming Rendlesham was of no defense significance. They use their institutional prestige to just declare the problem solved, despite the evidence.
The second is official inquiries. These seem to promise investigation, but really just guarantee dismissal.
Exactly. The classic example is Project Blue Book. Despite reviewing thousands of cases and admitting many were unexplained, it was basically a show trial. It was designed to systematically reject the ETH hypothesis from the start.
Its function is to reassure the public that we checked and there's nothing to see here,
while ensuring the conclusion never challenges the sovereignty premise. The third technique is official secrecy and non-disclosure.
Removing the knowledge from the public sphere entirely?
This is the most operationally intense one. We saw this in the vanishment of the Westall records, the burning of the physical evidence, and the UK MOTI's systematic destruction of UFO files over decades. If the data doesn't exist, the problem doesn't exist.
And finally, the technique that hits the witnesses the hardest: disciplinary measures.
This involves formal attacks, interrogation, and just everyday dismissals, leading to a spiral of silence and intense self-censorship.
The harsh interrogation of the Rendlesham airmen threatening their careers. That's the textbook illustration.
And it ensures that every professional pilot, air traffic controller, or military officer understands that breaking the taboo will have severe personal consequences.
But beyond the political suppression, there is a huge psychological component, particularly around the abduction narrative.
The foundational case that created that template is the Betty and Barney Hill case from 1961.
So the Hills were driving home in New Hampshire. They saw a bright, silent light following them. Barney stopped the car, looked through binoculars.
And he claimed he saw humanoid figures looking back at him through windows on a flattened, pancake-shaped craft.
They drove away in a panic, and then they realized they had nearly 2 hours of missing time.
Troubled by this, and by Betty's increasingly vivid nightmares, they eventually sought help from a psychiatrist, Dr. Benjamin Simon. And in 1964, he used regression hypnosis to try and recover their memories.
And under hypnosis, they recounted this terrifying story of being taken aboard the ship and subjected to medical examinations.
By short, gray-skinned beings with large wraparound eyes, Betty was even shown a three-dimensional star map that she claimed showed where the beings came from.
However, the recovered memory framework immediately raises serious questions about suggestion and cultural influence.
Yes, specifically regarding the visual template of the alien, the classic gray alien description. Short, thin, huge, dark eyes. It bore a striking resemblance to an alien in an episode of the TV show, The Outer Limits.
And the timeline is the critical detail here.
That specific Outer Limits episode aired just 12 days before Barney's first hypnosis session, where he detailed the appearance of the beings.
Which suggests a powerful cultural contamination of the memory. The mind, trying to fill that void of missing time, uses available pop culture imagery to construct the narrative.
And this potential contamination is why many serious researchers advocate for what Dr. John E. Mack, a pioneering figure in transpersonal psychology, called militant agnosticism.
Which means what, exactly?
It's a position that acknowledges the experiences are profoundly real to the experiencers, but that we cannot assume we know the ultimate nature of the phenomena.
Mack argued that we have to move beyond the bias of mainstream science, which just pathologizes these non-ordinary states of consciousness and dismisses witnesses.
And this philosophical shift leads us to the interdimensional hypothesis, or IDH.
The IDH posits that UFOs aren't visitors from distant galaxies, but forms and beings from another domain that occasionally impinges on our reality.
And this model could account for the bizarre, impossible characteristics we saw in cases like Rendlesham and the Belgian wave shapeshifting, sudden appearance and disappearance, violating physics. If the craft can move between dimensions, that explains the zero to supersonic acceleration.
We can contrast that with the high-stakes ETH interpretation from scholars like Don Dondari and David Jacobs,
who argue that UFOs are strictly physical, highly advanced craft, and that the abduction phenomena must be seen as an existential threat requiring a military response.
So we're left with three leading attempts to categorize this mystery.
The psychosocial hypothesis, PSH, which says it's all mythology and delusion. The extraterrestrial hypothesis, ETH, which says it's physical invaders. And the interdimensional hypothesis, IDH, which says it's real but non-local phenomena.
And none of them entirely captures the full spectrum of what we've examined today.
The persistent strength of the evidence in cases like Westall and Alderney suggests we can't just use the PSH to dismiss the physical reality. But the strange behavior and psychological elements challenge a purely ETH model.
So what does this all mean for you, the well-informed citizen? We've reviewed cases where the evidence is overwhelming. It's multi-layered visual radar, physical traces, and it's provided by professionals whose credibility is paramount.
From dozens of United Airlines employees at O'Hare to a mile-long object seen by Captain Boyer and confirmed on ATC radar near Alderney, the data is robust.
Yet the official institutional response is nearly uniform. Denial, record destruction, or far-fetched natural explanations like ambient weather conditions.
And this raises an important question. If the sheer weight of professional testimony and hard evidence, like a mile-long structured object confirmed by radar, can be instantly neutralized by a simple government or military denial, what does that tell us about the fragility of the reality we accept?
The mystery of the UAP is forcing us to examine not just the skies, but our own power structures and our perception of authoritative truth. It's pushing us into that state of militant agnosticism.
It's forcing us to publicly acknowledge that we simply cannot, at this stage, definitively determine the ultimate nature of this strange, persistent phenomenon.
Consider again the field that was burned at Westall to erase the evidence. If the craft seen by 300 witnesses was purely a terrestrial secret aircraft, a prototype military jet, why would the response be not just denial, but swift, complete destruction of the physical trace using soldiers and fire?
The choice to erase the physical data, rather than just ignore it, suggests they were afraid of what the evidence, even if it was purely terrestrial, might reveal about the technology, or the sheer unprecedented level of government secrecy involved.
Thanks for listening.
Until next episode.